Listeners, we have a powerful one for you today.
Mm-hmm. Today, we interviewed the Pelletiers, who is a couple that actually, they hosted an Airbnb for our executive producer. And they're like, oh, we've served with 518 before. So Sue was like, let's get them on the pod. They served with what was then our Safe Families program, which is similar to a non-governmental foster care, essentially, to kind of keep kids from going into the system, but giving them a safe place to stay. And we wanted to interview them because, you know, this story is not all sunshine and rainbows. Not everything turned out the way you might hope. And yeah, we were thankful for the things that they were willing to share.
We hope you enjoy. So, Taylor, the living room is full.
It's full. We have two guests.
First time we've ever had
two guests. Whole guests.
Yes.
We are whole.
Yes.
Well, and praise God for that.
Yeah. Our bodies, maybe not our minds. Yeah.
Well, please tell us who you are.
Well, so I am Matt Pelletier, and I am a professor at the medical school at Liberty, and this is my wife, Pam. I'll let her say a bit more about herself, but we have been married for 33 years as of August of this year.
Amazing.
And my name's Pamela, like he said. And let's see, I was a stay-at-home mom for many years, and we moved here to Virginia in 2013. And at that time, I started thinking about becoming a realtor. And so actually my daughter and I became realtors at the same time. So she works at Liberty right now and is a realtor. And since we have an empty nest almost, our youngest is in college. Mm-hmm. So it gives me something fun to do in a ministry as well.
Amazing. Wow.
So,
how many children do you have?
We have four.
Yes. So our oldest son is Ryan. He's 30. He is a software engineer for Amazon Web Services. Wow. And then Isaac, who is a Rustburg biology teacher, as we've mentioned.
Who happens to teach my 14-year-old. Yep. So I will extend my condolences or congratulations, depending on the day.
Well, I haven't heard the name, so it can't be that bad.
That's good.
So.
Right.
And then our daughter, Cassie, is 26, and she, wait a minute, is she 26?
25.
She'll be 26.
You're making
in
her
April.
Older.
Mm-hmm. I am. She is an administrative assistant at the medical school, does realty, as Pam mentioned. And then our youngest, Eli, is 22. He's a senior computer science student at Liberty.
Wow. Wonderful. So he's the one that's still kind of home, but mm-hmm. most of the time he's not. Mm-hmm. He stays on campus.
Yeah. So you moved to Lynchburg, or did you move somewhere else in Virginia in 2013?
So we actually got married as Liberty students.
Oh, wow.
And then we left here. I was an elementary education major, and we left here to go to Virginia Tech so he could get his PhD. Mm-hmm. Then we left there and went to Cornell, and then Matt taught at a small Christian college. He taught biology classes for 14 years. And then in 2013, he was offered a position at LUCOM. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
So we brought all of our kids here.
Which was, it was, for two of them in particular, it was challenging. Our oldest had just graduated high school, so he was in for a change no matter what. So mm-hmm. for him, it didn't matter so much. But Isaac was going into his junior year of high school. Cassie was going into her freshman year of high school. Eli didn't matter so much. He was in fifth grade, and mm-hmm. he kind of adapted pretty easily. But, you know, the older two had to go from a place where they had spent their entire lives to all new. And the school that they went to here, all three of our youngest went to Jefferson Forest. Mm-hmm. And the school that they went to in New York was a K-12, mm-hmm. and there were only about 50 kids per class, wow. so it was a big change for them.
And how was that transition? I mean, you're 11 years out. How did that work for your family?
I think it's been great. It's been definitely harder on Pam. I'll let her say more about that. But she doesn't like change at all. And her entire family, she grew up on a farm in about an hour from where I used to teach in New York State. And so for her, it was much more challenging to kind of leave because her parents and many of her siblings were all within an hour or two at the time. And I think it's been I'll let her speak to what she thinks about how it's turned out. But I think it's turned out great.
Well, my husband's mom and sister have moved here, which makes it nicer to have some family here. And now that three of my four children are married and we have three grandchildren, it's home now. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want to move back to New York now.
Mm-hmm. That's actually the first time I've heard her say that.
Wow. Whoa.
That she wouldn't want to move back to New York.
Yeah. It's because our kids are all here with their kids.
Exactly.
It has become home. So, yeah.
That's wonderful.
Your village is here.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are so many people who move in and out of this area we live in a locality that has five colleges and universities. We have global headquarters of a few manufacturing facilities. There are a lot of people that move in and out of the region.
Right.
And, you know, it's hard when you think of who is your new village and how do you form meaningful relationships. Mm-hmm. So that may be comforting to someone who is just in the midst of that to hear that sometimes it's better. One of our last guests talked to us about moving from Texas to Lynchburg, and they didn't even know why they were moving here.
They didn't know where they were moving. They just knew they were supposed to leave. So they packed up and left.
Wow.
Yeah. That's bold.
Yeah.
Courageous.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
One of the things that's been huge for us is in terms of our kids and the adjustment is really great youth pastors that have really connected with our kids and very spiritually mature youth pastors. And you don't always get that in a church. A lot of times the youth pastors, the
personality hire.
The personality,
the hype person.
Yeah, the hype person or and usually, somebody who has no experience. And in our case, the kids' youth pastor in New York is like our age. He's been in youth ministry for probably 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Choosing youth.
Yes, choosing youth.
Not just taking the job because it was the only one.
That's
it's not a stepping stone. It's his career.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then when we moved here, we had another Buck Romero who is at Bedrock Lynchburg now. Mm-hmm. He's not a youth pastor anymore, but he was when we moved here, and he really invested in our kids as well. And then
Josh Pugh
as well
at Bedrock in Bedford.
With our youngest. Mm-hmm. So.
It's wonderful.
That's been huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't easy, though, for our 10-year-old. Mm. He was 9 or 10 going into fifth grade. There were some challenges. There are some things that if they were really close friends, if they had said things to him, he could have let it slide off his back. But because they were, kids that he didn't know very well, he didn't take some things very well. It was hard at times, but for the most part, he did well. And we moved into a neighborhood that has kids, and we made sure that he would have some support and kids to play with there.
It was actually one of the things that drew us to that house is that out of all the houses that we, a lot of houses we went by, you wouldn't see like anybody outside at all. No kids playing around, no adults on the porch or whatever. And it wasn't like that in our neighborhood. And we were like, maybe this would be nice.
Right. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So we're going to switch gears a little bit. Tell us what brought you to the services at the then Patrick Henry Family Services. So how did you get involved with some of the programs?
So I think it was kind of my idea. And I had a colleague at the medical school, a guy named Jason Wells, who I saw with some young kids one day that I knew were not his kids at LUCOM. And then he told me about Safe Families. And I just, I thought, wow, that's a really, great way to invest in kids when they're really in need. a few years before we moved here, I had visited Sierra Leone in West Africa. And at the time that I was there, it was dead last on the World Health Organization's Human Development Index.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So I just saw so many horrific things there, and it broke my heart. And it actually triggered a clinical depression in me. Mm. It was one of the main things that triggered it. And but it gave me much more of a heart just in general for what people grow up with and what they go through and how they need help. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw Jason doing this, I thought, you know, we could do that. And so then I mentioned it to Pam, and then we got more information about Safe Families, and that's kind of how it got started.
We had thought about foster care before, but when you look into how many hours of training it is, that was so extensive, we didn't think we'd have time to do that or time to set it aside. That was when we were in New York.
Yeah.
And then once we moved here and when we found out about Safe Families, it's not as extensive training. And so we thought, and it was only supposed to be for a month that we had these children.
Yeah.
It ended up changing.
Yeah. We'll say more about that in a minute. But yeah, I had forgotten about, we looked into foster care in New York because we had friends who did it in New York. But it was, you know, it was like, I don't know how many weekends dedicated to training. Mm-hmm. And it just really didn't work very well with my job and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, and I know that I'm sure that there are good reasons for it. But there was a part of me that just thought, good grief, we've got four kids. We've never had any, you know, we're stable family. Nobody's ever reported us for something.
Right. The training felt like a barrier.
Can't we just help, you know? Mm-hmm.
So what did the, sorry to interrupt. What did the training, quote unquote, training look like for Safe Families? What was the process of getting started at that time?
I mean, I feel like it's been a while.
Yeah,
it's probably been 7 or 8 years now since we actually did it.
We filled out an application.
I mean, it was just, from what I recall, it was fill out an application, do a, you know, they did a background check on you, of course. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like it was just kind of like some conversations about what does it typically look like for a child to get placed with a family through Safe Families. And that kind of goes back to what Pam was saying, because what was initially described to us was, you know, Safe Families tries to act as a bridge to be preventative in a sense, so that a parent who is struggling often reaches out to Safe Families prior to something catastrophic happening and them losing their child into the foster care system. And so we had originally, at that time when we were asking about it, I think they had said it was like, oh, the average stay is like 2 weeks or 3 weeks or something like that. But in our case, we ended up, it's more complicated than this, but basically we ended up having those kids for about a full year out of about a year and a half long time frame. So they were kind of in and out because the, you know, the mother had issues and relapsed into some of the behaviors that had led to the kids being taken from the home to begin with.
So it was extended. So we'd like to hear whatever you feel comfortable sharing. Start with the good. What was the good of being a Safe Family?
The kids were very lovable. I remember we met in an Arby's parking lot the first time. There was like a go-between person, Safe Families person there. We did not meet the mom initially, but they came into our home and we enveloped them just like they were one of our children, read them stories, fed them, took them places. One of the boys was in school. The other one was 2 years old and he was just learning to speak at that time. He was not potty trained. You know, throughout the time that they were with us, we have great memories. And then we have some that are like, wow, what happened? Mm-hmm. But it was good to see them grow and mature. But as time went on, we heard, like, the older one, he was 8 years old when they came. So an 8 year old and a 2 year old, they were half brothers. I believe they had different dads. But the older one would open up and share more of what happened in his background. And it's shocking that some things like this can happen in our country, in our backyard, really, you know. So those kids, we grew to love them. And they became friends with the kids in our neighborhood. I remember when the 8 year old, for Valentine's Day, he wanted to buy a dozen roses for the girl down the street. And I thought,
that's serious. Well, that's a commitment, buddy.
Yeah. The funny thing is, it's not the first time that girl had a dozen roses given to her.
Yeah. Oh. As 8 years old, apparently. Wow. She must be a popular girl.
Yes. So anyway, but like Matt said, they stayed with us for about a month the first time, and then they went back to the mom. And I don't remember what it was, but within a month during the summer, the state, the police, took them away again. They didn't feel like the mom, they didn't feel like they had to go into foster care yet. They felt like the mom could, you know, get a job, get off the drugs. I don't know how many, what kind of details I should or should not say, but I'll try to be careful. Okay. But they thought she could kind of rehabilitate. Mm-hmm. And so the kids did come back to us, and I would take them to their doctor appointments, take them to counseling appointments, and also to visitation with their mom. So that was, you know, it was a full-time position, really, keeping them as kids.
Guardianship?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. So I have a question for – I have lots of questions, but how did it feel when they left the first time? So you had them for a month. Talk to the audience about what does that feel like? Because I know people who are listening think about foster care, and you look at, you know, they're always advertising for it. How we were in a training yesterday about shepherding, and I'll try not to go on too much, but we talked about, as a shepherd, how you really can't protect your heart, but you can prepare your heart. So is there anything that you could share that might prepare someone's heart for if they're thinking about something similar to this?
I will say that those 40 hours, I think it's 40 hours that fostering requires of you, they're probably really good and necessary. So don't shirk the training.
I would say for me, and again, it's been so long, it's a little hard to tell, but I think, you know, after the first, well, let me piggyback off the question about the good. I think for me, one of the most, one of the best things about it was just feeling like, okay, we're doing something good. We are making a difference in these kids' lives. And watching, again, you know, the 8 year old, he couldn't tell time. His reading was really weak. Just obviously the environment that they had been in was one where they just had not been able to, you know, develop the way that they should have. The 2 year old, when he, you know, if he wanted a banana, he'd say, nah, you know, and it's like, you know, and his attention span was like zero, basically. He was like a wrecking ball. I mean, if there's anything that I can get into, and not in a malicious way, but just like, if there's anything I can get into,
he's so busy.
Yes. Children from trauma or children from neglect have very real habits and have, you know, there's a lot of research now about kids who experience trauma before they're verbal. And that's terrifying to think that it may do more damage when the kids are nonverbal.
And this 8 year old, he was taking care of his younger sibling, and they just had a sister.
She was an infant. She went to another family.
Well, so there were three children.
There were. And we didn't feel like we could take all three. And obviously they wanted to try to keep them together, but they couldn't find anyone to take all three. Mm-hmm. So we said we would take the two boys. And we did get together with the mom that took the infant girl, mm-hmm. So they could keep in touch. But the first time when they left after the 3 or 4 weeks, it was kind of a little bit of a relief, a breather.
That's what I was going to say.
Because that's what you thought you were doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, right.
But on the other hand, we were like, there's so much that we would still like to tell them and teach them, because we were, you know, reading Christian stories to them and teaching them about Jesus and that he loves them. And I don't think they had heard that before. So.
Yeah. And we were intentionally trying to stay connected when they went back to mom. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, we offered to like pay for a summer camp for the 8-year-old through like Thomas Road. And that was actually one of the first sort of warning signs that things weren't great, was the mom, you know, Pam would be like, okay, well, I'm going to come pick up, you know, your son to take him to camp. Oh, and then she'd call the morning of, oh, you know, we're sick. Or it just became obvious before long that there was always, not always, but 80% of the time, there was some sort of excuse why it couldn't happen, which, you know, probably there were other things going on.
Right.
But I remember the sense of relief. And that kind of goes to the, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And the bad was, it went not really bad. It's just, it was so hard. Mm-hmm. When you go from, you know, you've got basically three children that are either out of high school or almost out of high school. And your youngest is, you know, he's 22 now. So he would have been like 14 or 15.
I think he was ninth grade maybe.
When they came into the home. And actually that was a whole other dynamic because he wasn't. And I know he didn't necessarily always treat them the best. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was frustrating for him too, because it's like, well, these kids are in my home wreaking havoc and I can't necessarily do what I want to do or, you know, whatever. So that was challenging for him.
At times our youngest would help us and be helpful toward them and do things with them. But there were also times when he wasn't mature enough to handle, kids that had been brought out of trauma. Mm-hmm. And when I say brought out of trauma, it's also traumatic for them to be in our home.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Even though we have a pretty stable home.
Being with you is a trauma.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So,
wow.
And it was hard on the dynamics of our youngest with us and with the two new boys in our home, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, again, so we would have been in our, you know, mid-40s or so when this happens. And to suddenly have a 2-year-old in your home when you're in your mid-40s.
Yeah. And your youngest is 14.
And your youngest is 14 and you're – and not just any 2-year-old, but a traumatized 2-year-old who is underdeveloped and very hyper and not potty trained or anything. It was hard, especially after they came back for the longer extended stay. And, in fact – you know, to be just completely blunt, by the end of their time of their second stay, we were just butting heads like crazy. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget the sense of, oh man, you're in trouble. You need help. Mm-hmm. And, I remember what triggered that was, having the thought, well, what would life be like if Pam and I weren't together?
Mm-hmm.
And which is a thought that I would have immediately dismissed at any other point in time up to that point in our marriage. You know, we've been married, you know, 27 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I had pondered that thought for probably about 30 seconds or more. And I was like, this is not good. This is not okay.
That's not healthy.
No. And so we ended up getting counseling actually through 518. And now it's all just, you know, rainbows and
of course, because that's how every story ends.
Right.
And...
No, but it was actually really helpful for us and it got us back to be much more solid in our, you know, our marriage. And I haven't had any thoughts like that since that point in time, and hopefully she hasn't either. She's always said, "It's till death do us part." She'd kill me before. Yeah,
I think we cut that part. Yeah.
Life is messy, and sometimes people just need someone safe to talk to. We're here to listen because everyone's story should be heard. 518 Counseling exists to empower children, adults, and families to overcome past experiences and create a path to being stronger both mentally and spiritually. Family is a nuanced concept. 518's family care team brings simple solutions to complex situations through professional intervention, interpersonal support, and parenting education. We strive for an outcome of mending families and keeping children safe. 518's Connect team equips and empowers volunteers with the training and support to serve confidently by matching their passions with opportunities. Our outreach is targeted to build partnerships with individuals, churches, agencies, and businesses. At Hat Creek Camp, we provide exceptional camp experiences with careful attention to the needs of youth, encouraging campers to grow through trust-based challenges and successes. It's a place to build relationships, inspire change, and transform lives.
What else would you say about the bad? I mean, that's bad and that's ugly and that's vulnerable to say. What would you say about what were the bad parts about opening your home to vulnerable children and being a safe family?
Well, emotionally, between our youngest and between me and my husband, that was the hardest part. Other smaller things were our possessions, like, and this is so trivial, but one of my phones, actually, this was a different boy. I'm trying to think. A different boy that came from Safe Families also, he took my phone and broke it on purpose, just smashed it to pieces. And but going back to one of the two boys,
that, so I guess it wasn't my phone.
But one of the two boys that we had, he took it was our daughter's watch, and he gave it to the girl, down the road.
Apple Watch.
Little Romeo.
Yes,
my goodness.
Little Romeo, too. Yes. And so her parents actually called us and said, I'm not sure if you're aware, but something else that happened is the older boy started urinating under his bed at night, and the bathroom was right next door to the bedroom. Mm-hmm. So I asked him, why did you do that? Because to me, that's not a normal behavior. And he said, well, I couldn't see very well in the night, so we put in some nightlights. Mm-hmm. And then when it happened the next time, why did you do that? And it just happened over and over and over. That was just really
difficult.
We replaced
basically all the carpets on the second floor after this was all over, because it just needed to be done. Mm-hmm. It was pretty bad.
Yeah. So, but that wasn't as hard as the emotional part. Really,
but even things as a parent of four children, you thought I can do this. I know potty training. I know, but when you are parenting or you're fostering someone else's children, and you don't know what they've gone through, and you don't know the trauma, you don't know how it's going to materialize or manifest.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This is not on the sheet, but. Last summer, a movie came out, Sound of Hope, the story of Possum Trot. Have you all seen it?
I have not. I've heard about it. I've heard good things about it, but I haven't.
Not yet.
You might want to when you are emotionally ready, because some of the things that you all have described about what you felt with your marriage and your biological children are in that story, and it is not easy to watch. And it is so incredibly powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the things that you've said echo some of the things that Brian Moss said.
I was thinking the same thing.
We had an earlier episode with a staff member from 518 who does.
I mean, he fosters. Oh, do you mean
mentoring.
His position?
Yeah, what is it?
Adventure-based mentoring.
Adventure-based mentoring. So he has a trauma-informed background, but he fosters and has biological children. And he was talking about how he has to have different conversations with his biological children than he does with his fosters about behavioral expectations. Mm-hmm.
There's a different grace that the foster kids get that the biological kids don't, because
so that's hard for them to understand. Yeah. Because, like, well, why do you let them get away with this?
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right.
That's understandable.
Mm-hmm. And there are so many things in that movie. And I think once we know better, we do better. And now that there is more out there about trauma-informed and ACEs, you know, the adverse childhood experiences, you know, there are reasons why the kids that you fostered, the kids that came into your house as a safe family, there are reasons why lots of kids act that way.
Sure.
And how important it is that we do prevention work, because it is so much easier and so much better to prevent it than intervene in it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I would have loved to know how to prevent that. Mm-hmm. But, the urinating mm-hmm. under the bed. Right. So, your complete bladder in the night.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you went to the bathroom beforehand, too. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. But our older kids did great with the two foster boys. I call them foster boys, but though mm-hmm. it was through mm-hmm. safe families.
Of course,
And those kids loved them because, you know, they played well with them. Even though they weren't home most of the time, when they did come home, it was like, you know, big brother, big sister coming home. Yeah. And that was always good.
So you have a picture, I remember, of the 8-year-old, like day 2 that he was in our home. The first time, Isaac took him fishing at a pond around the corner, and he caught this big bass. Mm. I still got that picture, and the 8-year-old just smiling as big as can be. So, yeah, the hardest part, I think, was just, I mean, it was just physically and mentally exhausting. And I think that led to a lot of our, you know, frustration with one another. It's like, you know, I don't want to do this right now. I need to veg out. And like, well, so do I. And, and, you know, to be fair, I'm sure that Pam did more than her fair share. I mean, she probably has a lot more reason to beef than I do about that. But
one thing that was very helpful was respite care. Mm. So there were some safe family. There was a team that surrounded us that gave us supplies, some gift cards sometimes, because, you know, we're spending our money taking them out to eat, you know, feeding them. And but there were clothes that were given to us for the boys, toys. And I remember our daughter, I think, was graduating. We had a graduation party for her. Mm-hmm. And the party was at my house. I feel like I always have to do everything, you know, from scratch and cheap. That's just me. I'm part of a personality flaw. but I was just going crazy. It's like, you know, having the little ones there and then trying to get the graduation party ready for my daughter and being kind of emotional about that. Some things, you know, come along with that.
Of course.
So, but we were able to call safe families, and they immediately got someone that could come and pick them up that morning and take the boys just for the day.
It's amazing.
You know, I would have loved to have them with us, but it was just too much for me at that point.
Well, and actually, I'm having a slightly different memory than you, although I think what you said is true as well. But I think that the second or the third time that the kids came back to us, we knew that there was going to be this graduation party coming up. And I feel like you were even like, I just don't know if we can do it, or I don't think we can do it. And I was like, well, it's never going to be convenient. You know, like, we need to do this. And so we did it. But yeah, it was, I would say the single biggest thing for that would have helped us is more respite care. Like, I'm sure that there's balancing the needs of the hosts and balancing the needs of the kids, because you don't want to be sending the kids off to some other random house every weekend or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even if we could have had, you know, one night a month with no responsibility, that would have been huge, because it was just so draining.
And to some listeners, you know, when you said respite care, I immediately went, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, to some listeners, that may be a foreign concept, because respite sounds so formal.
Yeah.
But many, many of us as parents, and my children are now adolescents, but sometimes I still need respite from them. It's not physical parenting as much as it is emotional that comes along with adolescence. But if you have grandparents, if you have godparents, if you have people in your village who take the kids to an event one night a week or youth group, or I mean, normal. Right. And that's very normal to have respite from your biological children. Right. So I think that there may be this extra layer of responsibility or an extra feeling of burden when you're fostering. Mm-hmm. And that makes so much sense for foster parents or, say, families to have respite.
I'm sitting here listening to you guys speak about respite care. And I don't even think I realized that there was respite care specifically for safe families. Like, in my mind, safe families was equivalent to respite care, because you guys were doing a form of respite care for the biological parent, but having that available to you.
The respite needed respite.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In fact, last night we had our 3-year-old and a 1-year-old grandchildren with us overnight. And it was the first time keeping the 1-year-old. But this morning I woke up and I was like, oh, now I'm remembering what this is like. Wow.
Right. And you know, our 7-month-old grandson, she had him all day as well.
Oh, wow.
And
so, yesterday.
It was kind of a reintroduction to watching, you know, little ones full time for a day.
Yeah. Which is complete and total blessing, but you're reminded of how physical it is to watch over and keep safe.
You got to be focused and
dialed in.
Yes.
And I was loving it at the same time. You know, we plan these sleepovers with our grandchildren. So, but I was just getting a cold at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it was just like, bam. Mm-hmm. But it is a blessing. And we are very thankful to live in a community where our kids are here, where Safe Families is here. Mm-hmm. It's an awesome program. There's also Miriam's House? I'm not exactly sure.
Isaiah,
yes, thank you. Isaiah, is it fine?
Where foster care starts differently.
That is, I have not actually been there, but to have a go-between from when the children are taken from their family and put into Safe Families or into foster care, that is huge, because at one point, the kids that we're talking about, they were taken away again, and they came and asked us first if we would take them, and we had to talk about it. Mm-hmm. It was after that year, and we weren't sure. And so those kids, I don't know where they were, but I'm so thankful that the Isaiah House is here now.
Isaiah 1:17.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I knew there was a chapter and verse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, we haven't done it a lot, but after we went through this in the counseling and everything, you know, after the kids were gone, we kind of... I don't want to say it's an absolute hard no, but we've kind of decided that, that's maybe not the best thing for us, but we'd be happy to do respite care for somebody else who is doing it, because, you know, we can handle anything for 24 hours, but it's just that when it's day after day after day,
absolutely,
you know, it's hard. But we have done it some, but not a whole lot.
We had some triplets.
Whoa.
Yes. That was. I don't even want to go there.
They were adorable, and that's why God makes children adorable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. He knows they need to be. Yeah.
When children are born in multiples, they have to be adorable.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
But and then we had another boy. I won't say his name just for privacy. Oh, yeah. It feels good to actually help a family. Mm-hmm. It really does. But you have to know where to draw the line. You have to know your boundaries. Mm-hmm. And we just realized how valuable respite is, and that's probably where we would fall into next.
That and, you know, financially being able to contribute. I mean, that's been something we've, you know, eagerly done anytime we see, you know, opportunities. There's always, we're not looking to drain our bank account completely dry, but I mean, when, you know, something comes up, we're usually able to help.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So and also when you hear other people that they're going to be doing foster care or venturing into Safe Families, it's it's a good reminder to pray for them and to encourage them because we know it's hard. And
actually, some friends of ours actually have the two boys that originally came to us and their sister as part of the foster care right now. And so we do on occasion, we have been able to have them over for the night or
we've been able to visit with them a couple times
take them
since
out for
then. So
lunch somewhere or things like that. And honestly, you know, we were saying how we probably never do beyond respite care again. Probably the only exception of that would be these kids. If they needed to be adopted or something, we'd still need to talk about it. But I think we've kind of come to the consensus that we probably would because we already have a relationship with them. And as hard as that would be, I have no desire to adopt those children, but I wouldn't let them just be perpetuated in the system because if I'm being real honest, the system stinks.
And I think that's why we're here talking about Mended Futures and why Vision 30, the goal to have all kids safe by 2030 in a family or in a family setting supported by a faith community. And it's not that the people in the system suck. The system is so broken.
So broken.
It's so overwhelmed and overburdened.
So there was a point at which the guardian ad litem, the the person advocating for the children, met with us in court, and I did not testify in court, but someone else from Safe Families did, and we were encouraging the court to have the kids go back to their mom. And it was really hard to be in there. The person from Safe Families was very direct, very honest about everything. And the guardian had so we were saying, okay, yeah, the mom still has some areas to improve in, but she has been doing so well. She got a job. She's not doing drugs right now. She's going to church. She's going to not an Alcoholics Anonymous,
but a support group.
Thank you, a support group, yes. And so I was even advocating for her to get her children back, and because that's the goal.
That's
yes,
always,
you're right.
Yeah.
We want the families to be together. And every time we saw them together, we could see how much the children loved them and how much she loved her kids. But this addictions to drugs, it destroys the person and the family. And I think we're going to see a lot more of it as, you know, drugs are just so prevalent in our society. But that guardian ad litem, he told me face to face, he said, she is not ready. And I didn't believe him.
He was right.
And he was right.
Wow. Probably was 6 weeks later, they were back out.
Yeah.
And I think for the folks who are listening, you know, in the Lynchburg, Virginia region, the two most common reasons that kids are taken out of their family environment and in state foster care where the government, the courts are involved, substance abuse and mental health. And they seem to go hand in hand. And they cause neglect. Yeah. They cause lots of other things that we think of around foster care. So sometimes it doesn't make sense in the Vision 30 space when we're talking about keeping kids safe and family stronger to do so much work with substance abuse, you know, prevention. But that's one of the best ways that we can keep families together, keep families stronger, is really prevent substance abuse because you've seen how hard it is to intervene.
And I think with both of those things, when someone is struggling so deeply with addiction and mental health issues, you're not dealing with that person themselves. It's when addiction becomes bigger than the person and that person is no longer recognizable that, you know, maybe it is time to call it.
That's heavy.
Yeah.
So totally switching gears to the topic of the podcast. And, you know, kind of closing things out here with let's reflect on the idea of mended futures. Are you all, answer this individually, are you the product of a mended future? Are you are you a healed part of something that happened in your family generationally? Have you ever thought of, you know, are your children mended futures? Are there any things that could have been generational that you didn't pass along to your children? Have you ever thought about that?
I haven't given it a lot of thought, but I will say that, you know, I grew up in a stable family. My mom and dad were married for 50, I don't know how many years. My dad got Alzheimer's actually at a young age. Young meaning like 60-ish.
That's young.
You know, she cared for him for another 16 years or so. I have great examples in my family. Mm-hmm. Certainly not to say that, you know, my parents were perfect or
of course.
Anything, but they, I always knew I was going to be safe. I didn't have to worry about, you know, being abused by my parents or neglected or anything like that. I was very well supported. I would not say that I'm would kind of fit that mended future for myself.
I mean, we're all sinners, so there's no perfect family. But I grew up in a farming family. I was one of six children, and I do not have abuse in my background. I do have a father that didn't really talk to us. Mm-hmm. he worked. He was a farming family. You work together. You didn't really. In our family, we didn't really discuss things. In fact, one of the things that drew me to Matt was he would actually talk about the Lord and talk. Mm-hmm. And I liked that. So it's, you know, there are things in all of our backgrounds. I think it's to what extent are we dysfunctional?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
and you know, my parents always took us to church. So I grew up in a good family. And I feel like every individual and every couple tries to do better than their parents did.
Yeah, and I would say actually related to that, you know, again, not abuse or anything like that, but I always knew my dad loved me mostly because he would spend time with me. Mm-hmm. He would come to all of my athletic events, and you know, he would we'd do a lot together. We'd play sports together and things like that. But if you ever thought about, like, I could count on less than one hand the number of actual meaningful conversations about life that I had with my dad. And that's one thing that I think and hope I've done much better at, is having, you know, real open conversations about things that matter with my kids.
And I think you've modeled that, too, with the decisions you've made to have kids come into your home. For better or for worse, you've showed your kids that it's important sometimes to step into the mess of other people to try and, you know, mend their futures if you're able.
I think it was good for all of our kids, even the youngest one, to see and to model that in front of them.
And I think
we have been blessed with awesome children, and
they're all right. Don't rank them here while we're on audio.
We've actually had other adults come and say, you know, what did you do? Or because we do have great kids and they're following the Lord, and we're happy about that. And it's, you know, it's not us, it's God. Mm-hmm. So
we probably had something to do with it too, but yeah, ultimately you never know how your kids are going to turn out. And you know, I'd like to think that, you know, we did a lot of things right, but I know we did a lot of things wrong. And I know there's a lot of parents out there who do a whole lot of things right and they don't get the same outcome. Mm-hmm. But I think it was really great for, you know, it's one thing to, you know, everybody knows that there are kids out there that are neglected or abused. But there's something very different, though, about developing a relationship with such a kid and hearing from their mouths how, you know, their mom's boyfriend was beating her and I jumped on his back and he threw me across the room and a gun was shot in the house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like for our kids to hear that, in fact, I know, because they kind of have said to us, man, we had no idea how good we have it. Mm-hmm. Like,
and that their kids sitting in the classroom with you, and you have no idea what their environment is like. And there are, you know, and sometimes people are doing the best they can, and other times people are not doing the best they can.
Sure.
Right. So having to reconcile that.
Yeah.
If you could talk to a family who is entering into the space of being a host family, being a safe family, I think the program across the country has kind of evolved, and, you know, different organizations put it in place in different ways, and there is more training involved. But what, I guess this is more of a twofold question, what would you say to the family, and what training did you wish you had received?
Well, I would say congratulations and thank you so much for filling a spot that is so needed and should be valued so highly because it's so necessary in our society right now. I would say also that develop your support group. If you have certain friends, you know, that you can rely on for prayer, for respite, you know, make sure that team is there before you start. That's my suggestion.
Say, buckle up.
Yeah, that too.
But I would also say, what you know, I have the most profound admiration for people who adopt and foster and and even do safe families, because it's very hard. It is a great example of self-sacrificial love, and I just think it's phenomenal. I'm very, very thankful that people do it.
Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for sharing your home in different ways. And I'm sure this will motivate people as we think about, where are you on the river? Are you going upstream? The least we can do is pray for people who are trying to decide, people who are opening their homes. But we could also be the village, like you described, Pam. You know, there were people that were providing gift cards. There were people that were helping you with respite. There are so many things that we can do as everyday people.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And I want to just encourage and thank you guys for the involvement you've had in whatever capacity. You know, some people might look at this and, if people were in your situation, they might be like, oh, like we failed. We couldn't keep these kids. And but it's not a failure. It's exactly what you had the capacity to do. And the Lord was with you and he healed you. And to step in any way is worthwhile, and it counts and it matters. So thank you for wanting to continue to be involved.
You're welcome. It's messy. Reminds me of a book title that I read a long time ago. I don't remember the author or anything else, but the title was, "If you want to walk on water, you've got to get out of the boat."
I was just thinking that.
And you got out of the boat.
You have to get out of the boat sometimes and stretch yourself.
So. Possibly something that might help is a counseling session once a month.
Yeah.
for the family that takes in the safe families.
I hadn't even thought about that.
That would be huge.
That's great.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Not just us, but the whole family.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
But the impact that it will have on the family.
Yeah. We don't regret any of it.
No.
We're thankful that we were able to do it, and
it was good for
that
us.
We did it for a time.
Ultimately.
Mm-hmm. 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 And who knows if something changes in the future? You never know what's going to happen.
Right. You never know.
Thank you for listening to the Mended Futures podcast, hosted by Allison Jordan and Taylor Melvin, produced by Liam Chafin, Sue England, Allison Jordan, Robert Day, Sully Jugar, and Taylor Melvin. You can find us on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to like, share, and subscribe to see more.